Does it bother you when you hear or see media coverage of elections and campaigns that focuses on who's winning and who's losing? Do you want that coverage to focus on the issues instead and not the so-called horse race? Like, what do the polls say, or what are the odds of someone winning? Well, you're not alone, and the news media often gets criticized for providing too much horse race journalism. So we were intrigued to see a piece in the current issue of the Columbia Journalism Review that makes a case for horse race journalism. Is there really a place for this? Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, September the 12th. We'll welcome your questions and your views about horse race journalism at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Greg Marks, a contributor for the Columbia Journalism Review. His piece in the current issue of CJW is in defense of the right kind of horse race journalism. Good morning.
Morning, Joy. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. So how are you defining horse race journalism?
I'm defining it just very simply as sort of coverage of a competition between rival candidates for elected office. Really just about, essentially, electoral competition. But I'm offering a defense of that coverage that's very much a qualified defense and that I think acknowledges the merit of a lot of the critiques that you opened the show by talking about.
Well, yeah, talk a little bit about who says horse race journalism in general is bad and why.
Well, media critics in general say horse race journalism is bad, including myself. I've offered that critique. In the piece that you referenced to, which can be found at cjr.org, I was addressing a critique by Jay Rosen, who talks about horse race journalism as sort of being sort of driven by the professional imperatives of the media and just a way for them to sort of signal that they're not really interested, or they don't have an invested, they don't feel invested in the outcome. They're not for any particular side. They're just trying to report about, essentially, in a very neutral way, on the competition. And I think that, as I said, I think that there's a lot of merit to that criticism. I think it does take a lot of attention away from the issues that we'd like reporters to spend more time on. And I think it produces a lot of repetitive, fairly meaningless journalism. But I do think that there is an important place for it, at least in some contexts.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the place for it. You wrote, "A meaningful answer to the question who's winning is, after all, one of the things that many users of political journalism want."
Right. So this is pretty much the market defense for horse race journalism. Simply just that, like, you know, this is what people are, it's basically political junkies or people who are, sort of abnormally interested in politics are for the most part people who consume political journalism. And, one of the things that they're interested in is just who's going to win. I mean, look at the success of 538.com, prior to the 2008 election. A lot of people were going to that every day looking for sort of like the very minor changes in his projections. But that's not really the core of the defense that I was offering.
You went on to say, but more important, it's information that under certain circumstances can empower democratic participation.
Right. So I think to understand the argument I'm making for, you need to sort of you need to understand the framework that I'm thinking about in terms of how elections and how campaigns operate, which is that especially in a primary election, which is of course where we are right now in the Republican Party, a lot of the important competition happens before the voters ever get involved, and that happens in terms of like where important, as insiders, essentially, high elected officials, important donors, important media figures who are aligned with a particular party, where they sort of argue amongst themselves about who the nominee should be, which is what's happening right now in the Republican Party. And there are really important sort of events in the campaign that are happening now and have already happened. I mean, we've seen Tim Pawlenty drop out. We've seen other people surge and fall. And the argument that I was making is, if you want to let, and all these things have happened months and months before, you know, the very first primary voters have had an opportunity to cast their ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So my argument was simply that if you want to give ordinary people, people who are not necessarily insiders but want to have more of a voice in the choice that their party makes, if you want to give them an opportunity to really participate, you need to give them accurate, timely information about essentially where the conversation among the insiders is going.
Yeah. So how does that though empower the voter?
Right. Well, there are a couple things you could do. So there's a blogger who I really like named Jonathan Bernstein has a phrase about American political parties that they're permeable. The sense is that, like, yes, there are insiders at the top of each party who make important decisions, but they're not just holed up in, you know, a smoke-filled room. I mean, they're receptive to information from other people. And if you really get active and get involved, you can actually influence what they're thinking. So part of that can mean, just making small-dollar contributions.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that can mean volunteering your time. Part of that can mean, you know, finding an insider who's accountable to you in some way. You know, maybe he's an elected official in your state or in your county, and organizing a letter writing campaign to sort of convince him or her that, you know, this candidate who you favor in the primary should be taken seriously.
I'm wondering what you think, Greg, of a lot of the stories that we saw after the Republican presidential candidate debate last week.
Mm-hmm.
That crowned Mitt Romney and Rick Perry as the front runners, saying that now we have, and now there are two.
Right. Well, I think it seems pretty clear to me and to most observers of the campaign that, you know, Romney and Perry are the two front runners of the debate. I don't know that we learned that from the debate. And it's kind of fun, you know, one of the funny things about campaign coverage, both in their primary and the general, is a lot of attention is paid to particular events, whether it be debates or whether it be a gaffe someone makes. And it's not always clear, you know, how much impact that particular event has. It's just sort of an opportunity for the press to, like, make a decision about where the direction of the campaign is. The sort of coverage that I'm talking about is much less influenced by particular events and much more sort of just based on, you know, having real connections within the party leadership, just really sort of understanding the direction of the conversation among the party leadership. And the good reporting that I feel like I've seen in that direction makes clear that, you know, there's certainly Romney has a lot of weaknesses within the party. Perry still seems to have plenty of weaknesses within the party, too. So they're both sort of compromised, but they are probably who we should understand as the two frontrunners at this point.
We're talking with Greg Marks. He is a contributor for the Columbia Journalism Review, CJR. And we are talking about his piece that's in the current issue, In Defense of the Right Kind of Horse Race Journalism. Reporters often get criticized for providing horse race coverage of political campaigns, but Greg says that a certain qualified kind of horse race journalism can provide valuable information for the public, especially in primary races. And we're wondering if you agree or not, or what's your critique of horse race journalism? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Checking the weather forecast for today, it's going to be sunny and warm today. We can expect high temperatures in the 80s. There is a chance of afternoon showers and storms in northwestern and north central Wisconsin. later today. Currently in Superior, fog in 52. In Wausau, clear in 55. In Eau Claire, clear in 59. La Crosse is cloudy in 61. In Milwaukee, partly cloudy in 66. Madison, clear and 61 degrees. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 19 minutes past 6 o'clock now on this Monday, September the 12th. Coming up this afternoon, it's back to school again for children and teachers, but what's new in Wisconsin's classrooms this fall? You can join in the conversation after 5 when Ben Marins and his guests discuss some of the issues and challenges facing teachers, administrators, and children as the school year begins. That's coming up during At Issue with Ben Marins between 5 and 6 this afternoon. We are talking about horse race journalism. And we wonder if you think reporters pay too much attention to so-called horse race journalism, who's winning and who's losing. We're talking with a reporter who makes a case for horse race journalism, at least the right kind of horse race journalism. And we wonder what you think. And maybe you have some examples of horse race journalism that you find valuable. Or maybe you don't think there's a place for it at all. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is a contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. His name is Greg Marks, and he has criticized horse race journalism in the past. Horse race journalism that dwells on what the polls are saying or what the pundits are placing odds on who's going to win, that sort of thing. But he says that horse race journalism, especially in primary races, can empower Democratic participation. And we welcome your input. Maybe you even have some critiques of the way the media are covering the current presidential race. Quint on Facebook writes, "For Rosen, the problem is reporters covering campaigns from the perspective of a professional campaign operative and not from that of voters. The focus is on metrics, messaging, and other tactics to win over voters. Issues may be part of the story, but only insofar as how they play in the campaign without regard to actual policies as end results." That's Quinn's assessment. Is that yours too, Greg Marks?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of merit to that criticism. I mean, there's a very sort of, for me, and I think for a lot of press critics, and I think for a lot of readers, aggravating style of horse race coverage in which the reporter essentially, you know, adopts his, you know, campaign strategist, you know, hat for the purposes of the story. And look, I mean, there's a certain, I suppose, news value in helping, you know, people who really really interested in these things understand how it's being thought about from the inside. I mean, you could probably sort of construct a defense of that sort of coverage too. But I do think that, I mean, the argument that I want to put forward is really written, is really about coverage that's written with a sense of, like, how do we empower ordinary people who want to become more involved to get more involved. And there's a great phrase that I think Rosen borrowed from someone else about, I'm going to botch it, but that sort of coverage sort of helps us become sort of like connoisseurs of our own bamboozlement. And I don't think that's exactly the right phrase, but it's more sort of that it lets us understand how we're being manipulated or how fellow voters are being manipulated. And that's not exactly the sort of coverage that I want to offer a defense for.
Mm-hmm. Well, give us an example of maybe something recent that is an example of the kind of horse race journalism you think does have a place.
Sure. So there's an interesting project that I've written about that Huffington Post and the local journalism network Patch are involved in together, and it remains to be seen how well it's going to work out. But I'm really intrigued by it. They're both owned by AOL, of course, so they can sort of pool resources on this. And what Huffington Post did, their politics reporters had Patch editors in places like Iowa and South Carolina and New Hampshire, sort of identify important Republican leaders in those states. You know, and these are county chairmen, committee members, you know, people that, you know, the average person has basically never heard of, but they do have real influence in their communities. And Patch and Huffington Post are polling or really surveying more than polling them on a regular basis about sort of how they view the race. And it's a way to sort of really take the measure of the conversation in these particular places. So I like it. I like that for a couple reasons. One that, you know, I just think it gives us a good reflection of sort of the direction of the conversation among one slice of the party elite or party insiders. There's certainly others. I also really like that they printed the name of, you know, every person whom they're surveying, which, A, you know, makes it sort of accountable. You know, we can know, you know, who's going into this. It's not just anonymous, you know, party insiders. B, if you happen to live in one of those places, they're telling you, you know, we as political journalists think this person is important, you know, for the purposes of the conversation about the Republican presidential primary in Iowa. And if you're an Iowa resident or an Iowa Republican, that's information that, you know, you might use to think about, these are the people who I feel strongly about who our primary, who our nominee should be. These are the people whom I need to communicate my views to or think about how I can work with or, you know, who I need to persuade. So I thought that was a sort of a pretty interesting recent innovation in this type of coverage, and is very much informed by the sort of the understanding of how primaries work that I'm writing from as well.
So is there, you know, another example that stands out to you on the type of horse race journalism that is useless?
Oh, that is useless? Mm-hmm. I think that they're abundant. I think that most of it is not very good. I mean, in the post I linked to, I sort of agreed with Jay Rosen, whom I was sort of criticizing, but there's this one of these, like, what to watch for in tonight's debate or in the month of September, you know, posts. I think it happened to be written in the New York Times, but it could have been written anywhere. You know, honestly, we see them every day in the major political press. And it's basically like, here's what insiders are saying, but not so much about, like, not... It's just essentially how to sort of pretend that you're a political pundit or pretend that you're a strategist, and these are the things you might think about if you did that professionally.
You wrote about different TV pundits in particular being asked, you know, what are the odds so-and-so is going to win, and actually literally placing odds on who is going to place in an election.
Right. And I mean, the sort of the great sort of example of the media's embarrassment and foolishness in recent times is the 2008 Democratic New Hampshire primary, where everybody was sure that Barack Obama was going to win. And, you know, and this was based on polling, and this was based on reporting. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't completely made up, but stories were written essentially about what was going to happen to Hillary Clinton's campaign after she lost 2 days in advance, and of course then she won. So what I'm saying, you know, is not, you know, use your powers of, you know, prognostication to predict what's going to happen in 2 days. It's rather, you know, tell us, you know, months ahead of time, you know, weeks ahead of time, you know, what's sort of the direction of the campaign, you know, who's being taken seriously, who isn't being taken seriously, and for what reasons and among what groups and that sort of thing.
Yeah. What do you think of the reliance of reporting the poll results in the media as often as we do?
I think it's really problematic, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, both, you know, in primaries and generals. You know, for one thing, in primary elections, which we've been discussing, poll results are very volatile. They're actually, in general, not that predictive of who's going to win, you know, especially well in advance in a primary election. Or a bunch of political scientists have studied these things, and poll results aren't completely meaningless, but they found that if you track who's picking up endorsements from you know, sort of important figures within the party, that's actually more predictive than early poll results, which essentially, you know, really tend to be driven by who's getting a lot of media attention at a particular moment. So the reporting of poll results is a very easy thing to do. You know, not every media outlet has the resources to run a lot of polls, but you run a poll, you get a story. You find someone else who ran a poll, you get a story. You call up a couple, you know, sort of talking heads within the party. You fill it out with a couple quotes. It's actually a lot more work to try and sort of understand the networks that are sort of driving the decision and driving the conversation that ultimately seem to have more influence over the outcome than what the early poll results among voters who are just starting to pay attention really do.
We are talking with Greg Marks. He is a contributor for the Columbia Journalism Review. We're talking about his piece in defense of the right kind of horse race journalism. He says when primaries especially decide party priorities, voters should be brought in on the conversation. So he says that a certain kind of horse race journalism can provide valuable information for the public, and we're talking about what kind of horse race journalism he's talking about and how it differs from traditional horse race journalism. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions and reactions. We'll continue after we check the latest news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Do you think there's too much coverage of who's winning and who's losing in the media and in the current presidential race in general? Or are you glad to see that kind of coverage at least once in a while? We are talking about horse race journalism during this hour, and we're welcoming your critiques of media coverage of politics, especially the presidential race. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter @JoyCardineShow. Greg Marks is our guest. He's a contributor for the Columbia Journalism Review, and we were intrigued when we saw his piece in the current issue that was making a case for horse race journalism. You don't see that very often. Turns out he is making a case in defense of the right kind of horse race journalism. And we're talking about what the right kind of horse race journalism is and why he says there's a place for it, especially in primary races. And again, we welcome your questions for him, and we welcome your thoughts in general on media coverage of the presidential campaign so far. Too much focus on polls? What do you think of the debate coverage? A lot of supporters of Ron Paul say that he's being ignored. What are your thoughts and questions? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Again, Greg Marks is a contributor for the Columbia Journalism Review. His piece in the current issue is entitled In Defense of the Right Kind of Horse Race Journalism. You can find it on CJR. Or you can find it on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page and on our website at WPR.org. And Greg Marks, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the debate coverage from last week. Some people complained that most of the questions went to Romney and Perry, and most of the coverage after the debate, if you didn't watch the whole debate, was just on their sparring over their various jobs, records, and that sort of thing, and that we didn't really hear anything or very much at all about what the other candidates were saying. What do you make of that criticism?
Well, I guess I'm sympathetic to it, but only to a point. It was Rick Perry's first presidential debate, and he's, you know, clearly an important contender for the nomination, someone who seems to have a real chance to win. So I think it's certainly appropriate for the moderators to to direct a lot of questions, you know, at him and make sure he has, you know, and hopefully to put him on the spot a little bit. And at the same time, Romney, you know, is generally considered the front runner, or at least a co-front runner along with Perry. So, you know, you wouldn't want the front runner to be, or, you know, someone who has a real chance to win the nomination to skate by either. I guess I would say, and the other thing I would say is that there are, you know, even in this early period in which, you know, we have a big field, there are a bunch of, you know, presidential debates. People will, different candidates, you know, if they don't get a chance to sort of be featured at one, they may be featured at another. You know, not too long ago, we had a debate that seemed to be all about Michelle Bachmann. So, I mean, I understand the criticism. I suppose I'm sympathetic to it. At the same time, it's hard for me to feel that, I guess, that upset about, you know, just, you know, someone doesn't get a chance to talk enough at one particular debate. Now, there are, you mentioned Ron Paul a moment ago. I mean, and sort of the his fans, you know, have sort of a line of argument about how he's systematically sort of excluded from conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about, you know, I've written a little bit about this. I mean, other people have written some very smart stuff about it. My sort of take on Paul is that he has a very committed base of supporters, and it seems to be perhaps a little bit bigger than it was in 2008. But Ron Paul is not going to win the presidential nomination, and that's not because of media coverage. It's not because he doesn't get enough media coverage. It's because, you know, he doesn't have the eventual nominee needs to draw support from all around the party. And Ron Paul is just, he doesn't seem to have any interest in doing that, and he doesn't seem to have any ability to do that. So I wouldn't, now that doesn't mean that reporters should not sort of take seriously the issues Paul raises, use the fact that he's raising these issues as an opportunity to explore them, examine why Paul attracts such intense, why some people are attracted to him so intensely and become such serious fans. I think all of those things are absolutely things reporters should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
But reporters should not be, you know, writing stories or, you know, doing radio broadcasts or anything in a way that gives the sense that Paul is a serious contender for the nomination, unless that there's, you know, some reason to think that he is. And, yeah, I just don't see that there is.
Another question stemming from the debate. The presidential candidate Newt Gingrich had some harsh words for one of the moderators at the debate last Wednesday night, and harsh words for the so-called liberal media in general.
Right. I, for one, and I hope all of my friends up here, are going to repudiate every effort of the news media to get Republicans to fight each other to protect Barack Obama, who deserves to be defeated, and all of us are committed as a team. Whoever the nominee is, we are all for defeating Barack Obama.
So were the moderators and the media in general, are they trying to cause the Republican candidates to fight?
Well, I mean, I'll confess, I didn't watch the debate live. You know, I've read a bunch about it. You know, I've seen some transcripts of excerpts. So I may not be the most qualified to speak to this, but, you know, I would hope that they were trying to get them to, you know, disagree over important issues, you know, whether or not that's fight or not. I don't know, but it's sort of the job of the moderator to bring out salient points of disagreement between the candidates. I mean, I would hope that they were trying to do that. Newt Gingrich is, you know, I think this is basically best understood not as a piece of press criticism, but as a piece of political strategy. A lot of, you know, conservative Republicans, and it's the more conservative members of the Republican Party who are most likely to vote in the primary, and, you know, sort of the inverse for the Democratic Party, really don't trust, you know, the so-called mainstream media. And, you know, we've seen many Republicans sort of use, you know, the opportunity to try to sort of, like, bash the media as a way to, you know, curry favor, you know, among sort of the most conservative element of the Republican Party. And, you know, I think that's basically what Newt Gingrich was trying to do there. He did the same thing in the Fox debate a little while back, and that was curious just because, if you know, Fox tends to be the media outlet that Republicans and conservatives, you know, sort of have the most trust in. So it was perhaps a curious piece of strategy when they tried it then. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that that's, we can understand what Gingrich is doing, you know, through that frame.
I was just broadening our discussion just a bit with the debate, since that was fresh in our minds in terms of media coverage. But your piece specifically was on this horse race journalism. Has there always been horse race journalism, or is it becoming more prevalent over the last few years?
I think all types of political journalism are becoming more prevalent. You know, we hear a lot about, you know, we hear a lot about sort of the death of newspapers and things like that. But I mean, there's been sort of an explosion of media online, and there's been tremendous growth on the web of you know, different outlets and some very influential outlets. So I think we probably have certainly more day-to-day political journalism than, you know, we've ever had or certainly have had in a long time. And the audience is probably bigger than it's ever been before. So, I mean, I think the question then becomes, does horse race journalism account for a greater share? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I don't know. I'm not enough of a historian to speak to that. I mean, there are certainly, I mentioned late in the piece that we've been discussing, a reporter named Chris, or a journalist named Chris Hayes, who works at The Nation, is now on MSNBC, wrote what I thought was a really smart piece in 2008, sort of offering some prescriptions for how to do better campaign coverage. And one of his pieces of advice was simply to publish less frequently, you know, take more time and publish less. And I think, you know, I think that would be really smart, and I think that would produce both better horse race journalism and better, you know, coverage of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're defining horse race journalism as, you know, this is what Mitt Romney did on the stump today, and this is what some folks said the significance of that will be, I don't think that's, for the most of the time, I don't think that that's very important or very meaningful. And I'm sure we do have more of it, and it may account for a greater share of the political coverage that we see, just because it's, you know, it's very reproducible. You know, any you know, you can send anyone out to do that, and I think what, you know, one of the sort of problems with sort of the shallow form of horse race journalism is it's, or one of the sort of the part of the appeal of it is it's very easy to understand how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we do have a little bit more of it than we used to, and I do think we have more of it than we should.
Yes. So do you think we'll see less of the shallow kind of horse race journalism and more of the right kind of horse race journalism as the presidential campaigns proceed?
I'm optimistic that we'll see more good stuff. I mean, I pointed to the HuffPost Patch collaboration earlier. That's a new effort. Politico, which gets bashed a lot by, you know, media critics, I think it has done some very smart, just straightforward pieces, you know, not new innovations or anything, but just some very smart, like, here's the conversation among Republican governors, here's the conversation among Republican members of Congress, and for reasons I explained earlier, I think that's, you know, that's really sort of important journalism, and they do that. So I hope we'll see more of the good stuff. I don't really have much hope that we'll see less of the bad stuff.
Well, we appreciate your time this morning. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks so much, Joy. I appreciate it.
Greg Marks, contributor for the Columbia Journalism Review. His piece in the current issue of CJR is In Defense of the Right Kind of Horse Race Journalism. Checking our weather forecast for today, sunny and warm with a chance of showers in northwestern and north central Wisconsin. Highs today will be in the 80s. Time for our Monday morning wake-up call. After this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Monday morning wake-up call this morning comes from the Wisconsin Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and it's for college students, or the parents of college students, as you're probably more likely to be listening right now, about the risk of identity theft. And if you have a question about identity theft, how to protect yourself or what to do about it if you're the victim of identity theft, we might have time for a question or two at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And while you're at it, you can also share with us other ideas for the Monday morning wake-up call. This is the time each week where we have a guest on who brings something to our attention, so something that we may not be aware of. The Monday morning wake-up call every Monday at 6:50. And with us to issue today's Monday morning wake-up call is Sandy Chalmers, administrator of the Wisconsin Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, we saw this news release out last week. This was timed for the start of college classes around Wisconsin. Why should college students worry about their identities?
Well, typically, college students think of themselves as being very poor, you know, not a lot of assets, not a lot of money in their bank account, so they don't think of themselves as being at risk for identity theft. But a quarter of all identity theft reports come from people in the age group of 20 to 29. And experts are telling us that the reason that college students in particular are more vulnerable to identity theft is they transact so much of their business online, of course. They receive credit card applications on a daily or weekly basis, sometimes, you know, half a dozen a day. And a lot of the students throw out those card applications without shredding them, which, you know, allows somebody to pick it up and change the address on it and mail it in. And, of course, college students are relatively new at being consumers, mm-hmm. so they rarely, if ever, check over their credit card statements and reconcile their checking account balances. And when you add all those things up, it's a lot of vulnerability to identity theft.
Yeah, I had no idea that a quarter of the cases are young people, young adults or college students. So what is your recommendation, especially for college students, though these are tips that could help anybody?
Mm-hmm, sure. The first thing that a college student should do is to check their credit report frequently, and that's something they would never think of, you know, especially if they don't have credit card accounts currently. But they should go to annualcreditreport.com, and by federal law, a credit report is available to anyone free at least once a year. And that's important because the fastest rising type of identity theft is new account fraud, where a criminal takes a combination of your personal identification, opens a new account in your name, changes the address, and of course never pays the bill. And that counts against your credit rating, but it can go undetected for months and even years.
Yeah, creeps. So, and also, you were saying that college students don't typically shred their credit card offers. You're saying they should.
They absolutely should. That is so easy for somebody to take advantage of that. And again, the experts say that the easiest way for an identity theft to steal from you is through old-fashioned dumpster diving or by stealing your wallet or purse.
Yeah, and does that mean buy a shredder, or can you just rip it up into tiny little pieces?
Well, I would advise having a shredder, and I don't know at this point whether dorms have shredders, but it really is an important part of safeguarding your identity.
Mm-hmm. You make sure you check over your bills and bank statements.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's really important for any consumer to look at their credit card statements monthly and look very carefully for unauthorized charges. Look over your phone statements and utility statements and make sure that you ordered everything that you're being charged for.
Yeah. You mentioned that the college student is perhaps more vulnerable because the college student does so much work online with, you know, with computers and even and smartphones. Is there something that when it comes to our computers and smartphones that that we ought to keep in mind?
Well, of course, just keep track of them. Have them password protected. And it's very important, of course, to have the most up-to-date antivirus and spyware on your computers.
Mm-hmm. Don't carry your Social Security card with you. I used to do that when I was a college student. I finally learned not to, but there's no need for that.
Well, Joy, on my college ID, my Social Security number was right on my ID.
That's right. It wasn't that long ago.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So, what else? What other tips for college students in particular to protect against identity theft?
Well, college students tend to move around a lot, so make sure the Postal Service is up to date on your moves, that they're notified of your forwarding addresses, because if all those credit card offers, pre-approved offers, you know, with the little checks in the envelope, go to somebody else, it's just so easy for somebody to take advantage of.
This is my favorite. Avoid leaving a credit card at a bar for a bar tab.
That is a very wise recommendation. And identity thieves have something that's called a skimmer, and it looks like the swipe that you run your credit card through. And what they do is run your credit card through the skimmer and capture your credit card information.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've talked to a number of people who have had their credit card accounts stolen in that way.
Well, we have just a minute or so to go. Let's say a college student, or anyone for that matter, believes they have been a victim of identity theft. Then what do you do?
Well, the most important thing to do first is to notify the credit reporting agencies. And under Wisconsin law, you can have a freeze placed on your credit report, which basically prevents anybody from opening a new account in your name. And the three credit reporting companies are Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. So that's the most important thing, because it keeps, you know, the identity theft from expanding. And second, of course, report it to the police.
Yeah.
Very important for you to do that. And if you send a report, police report, to the credit reporting agencies, they'll waive the $10 fee it costs you to place a freeze on your account.
Sandy Chalmers, thanks very much for issuing this week's Monday Morning Wake-Up Call.
Thank you, Joy.
Sandy Chalmers, Administrator of Wisconsin's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, telling college students to wake up and protect their identities. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.